Blog Talk Radio.
From the San Francisco Bay Area, it's time for Live from the Bay with Joey. Here's Joey.
Welcome to Live from the Bay with Joey. This is our special edition part one of The Spanish Jews Yesterday and Today. On this episode, we will be talking about the Spanish Jews, known as the Sephardim, the Sephardic, the people, their culture, language, and the future. These were the people, once a vital part of ancient Spain, since a time period of Roman antiquity, who lived well in Spain's golden years together with the Christians and the Muslims. They were expelled under the Alhambra decree in 1492 and in Portugal by order of King Manuel in 1497. Those that wanted to retain their Jewish religion were welcomed in by the Ottoman Empire, which, by the way, was greatly flourished by these people. Many others went on to North Africa, as well as Italy and the Netherlands. They left Iberia with their ancient 14th century Spanish and with basically no contact with their homeland of Spain. Their language, Hebreo-Espanol, especially in the Ottoman Empire, remained unchanged even now to this very day. Over 500 years later, these Jews are still in existence, perhaps in smaller in numbers than other Jews. For some, there may be the fear that the language, culture, and people are becoming extinct, but on this show today, we're going to let you know that this is really not the case at all. The Sephardic, the language, culture, and people are still very much alive today. I have asked some experts from the USA on the subjects of the Spanish Jews, the Sephardic, to speak this evening. Joining me today are the following individuals. It will be Rachel Amado Bortnik, a native of Izmir, Turkey, who came to America as a foreign student over 50 years ago and now lives in Dallas, Texas. She is the founder and moderator of La Vino Comunidad, an online group that corresponds only in Judeo-Spanish, also known as La Vino. Rachel is a Sephardic Jew, which means that her ancestors had come to Turkey, the old Ottoman Empire, from Spain. Her native language is Ladino. Dolores Sloan, president of the Society for Crypto-Judaic Studies, author of The Sephardic Jews of Spain and Portugal. Sloan brings one half century of expertise as writer, journalist, editor, speaker, and professor to our diverse publications and presentations. She is editor of the Journal of Spanish, Portuguese, and Italian Crypto Jews and former editor of Halapad, I think. I don't know. She may correct me. Journal of Society of Crypto-Judaic Studies. A knowledgeable and full skillful speaker, she has addressed audiences in museums and cultural centers, religious and community organizations on the subject of her book and related topics. She has taught public speaking and English at Mount St. Mary's College, Los Angeles, where she also taught women in Jewish history and culture. Also joining us will be Gloria Asher, was born in the Bronx, New York, of Sephardic Jews from Smyrna, now Izmir, Turkey. She grew up with the language Ladino, Judeo-Espanol, and with Sephardic culture, food, values, and atmosphere. Gloria writes poems, composes, and sings songs in Ladino, and has written and presented both in Ladino and in English on aspects of Judeo-Spanish culture and literature. She teaches Ladino language and culture and Sephardic tradition, among other things, at Tufts University. Finally joining me will be Brian Kirshen of New York City, graduate student at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. In the Department of Spanish and Portuguese, he focuses his research on Judeo-Spanish linguistics and is the founder, co-director of UC Ladino, a student organization dedicated to promoting the knowledge and use of Judeo-Spanish language. So join me for part one, the Spanish Jews yesterday and today. So I welcome everyone this evening, and shalom. Hope shalom. Everyone is doing well. Are
yes,
you all there?
Thank you.
Yes, shalom.
Thank you.
I want to remind you that this evening we will be conducting this group discussion, so we will not be stepping over each other and too many people chiming in at the same time. I will pose a question, and I will ask normally for one or two people to respond to that question. I will introduce the people that will be answering that question. I would just like to remind my guests, make sure you mute your phone unless you're answering the question, and that is it. So thank you all for your cooperation. And this evening, folks, we've got, let me just tell you where everybody's from, give you an idea. Rachel lives in Dallas, Texas. And Rachel, how's your weather in Dallas? Is it hot there tonight?
Hi, Joey. Yes,
hi there.
I had my mute button.
That's all right. Is it warm there? Is it warm there in Texas?
Yes, very hot, yes.
Yeah.
Of course, this is Texas.
Yeah. And then we've got Dolores Sloan with us, and Dolores is, from the basically Los Angeles region, Santa Monica, California, right? Dolores, how's it down there?
Well, it's lovely, sunny California weather.
I know, and we have that here in Northern California, so yay, you know. Also joining us will be Gloria Asher. And Gloria, although from the Bronx, New York, is living in Massachusetts. Is that correct, Gloria?
No, that's right. I'm in Hyannis,
okay.
Cape Cod right now.
There you go. Nice place to be. And then finally joining me will be Brian. So Brian, from New York City, but is also in Southern California, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to start off our discussion with the first question. I think I want to know, the listeners want to know, who are the Spanish Jews? And I'm going to ask Dolores and Rachel to answer that question. So we'll start off with Dolores. Dolores, can you tell me who are the Spanish Jews, the Sephardic Jews?
Okay, Joey. Let me start by saying that we have records that Jews lived in what is now Spain and Portugal or the Iberian Peninsula for over 2,000 years. And probably the largest group of them came after the Romans burned the Second Temple in the Holy Land in the first century. And so they were looking for places to go, and many of them went to a land that they called Sepharad, which you'll recognize, it's very much like Sephardic, the word Sephardic. It was a land that was known to be very fruitful, and so many of them went there to settle, and they became known as Sephardic Jews because they settled in the land that they called Sepharad. And today's Sephardic Jews are their descendants. They are the descendants of those who lived in now Spain and Portugal. And Joey told you a little bit about how they were exiled or forcefully converted to Catholicism in the end of the 15th century. And some of them came to the New World at that point because they felt endangered, and to other countries, as he described to you. But if their ancestry was in Spain or Portugal, then they would have Sephardic heritage. And if they're not now Jews, but they had been converted long ago, they would still have this Sephardic heritage if they know about it.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, because I know you and I talked about that on the phone because I had some questions about that. So thank you so much for sharing that portion. And now I'm going to ask Rachel if you would go ahead and chime in for me on who are the Spanish Jews or the Sephardic Jews. And again, folks, remember Rachel is Rachel was born and raised in a native, she's a native of Izmir, Turkey, who is actually Sephardic. So again, her native language was Ladino. Okay, and you're on, Rachel.
Hi, Joey.
Hi there.
I just want to add a little bit to what Dolly said, and that is that the word Sephard in Hebrew actually means Spain in modern Hebrew. I mean, like the king of Sephard would be the king of Spain. It's the word for Spain. And therefore, Sephardic comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the word where it comes from. The other thing I want to add is that the year of the expulsion from Spain, which was actually Castile and Aragon, right after Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand captured Granada from the Muslims,
yes,
was 1492, which is a year that is very well known all over the world, but
absolutely
very few associate it with a dramatic episode in Jewish history, which is the Edict of Expulsion of the Jews from Spain. Of course, as was mentioned, the edict gave us the choice of either staying Jewish and leaving the land of our ancestors in Spain, or converting to Catholicism and staying.
Mm-hmm.
And so from then on is the story of the Sephardic Jews, that as we know them today, of which I'm a part.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, I want to know, and so, Rachel, while we still have you here with us talking, I want to know what happened to these Jews. I'm going to ask yourself, and then Gloria is going to chime in as well. But can you tell us, while we're still, you know, you're still online here with us right now, what happened to these Jews?
Well, having the choice of converting and staying in the land where they were born and of which they were a part, many, many, many Jews. We don't have exact figures, but a large proportion actually converted to Catholicism and stayed. Some of them went to Portugal, which still received them at least temporarily. But even those that had converted eventually had to leave because of the horrible Inquisition that was in Spain, obsessed with so-called Judaizers. So we end up with hundreds of thousands, at least in the Ottoman Empire, we know that about 200,000 Sephardic Jews ended up settling. And just imagine this being within a very short period of time, and they were absorbed and given housing and so on. That's why we have so many Sephardic people in the Ottoman Empire. And later on I'll tell you as to what conditions made it possible for us to retain our Spanish language in that totally non-Latin, non-Spanish environment.
Yeah,
but
you know,
basically this is what happened. Eventually, the story, of course, is very long because some people went north to Holland and later England and then Brazil and ended up in New York City and so on.
Right.
So there is a very long history to tell there. But in our case, my case and Gloria's anyway, we are the descendants of those who chose to stay Jewish and settled in the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, you know what I find really interesting? I was talking to Dolores about this yesterday. What I find is interesting is that by decree, you have a king and a queen that, you know, are reigning in kingdoms, you know, and they decree, you know, they make this, declaration that we're going to get rid of the Jews, we want them expelled out, and the Muslims, those that don't convert. But in reality, which blows my mind, is many of these kings and queens that were making these decisions, they themselves were not even really Spanish people. I mean, they're descendants of people from Germany and Austria and places like that. And they were even the Queen of Spain today is not Spanish. And King Juan Carlos is very little Spanish descent. He's got, you know, Bourbon, German, Austrian, all this. So it's very ironic to me. It's very it's bothersome to me that you have a group of people that are throwing people that have been there for a long, long time, and that's their land, and you're throwing them out. And Lord knows how long these people were there. You know, they might not have been there that long, and their people probably were not from there. So it just, it's really bothersome when I hear about this. But anyway, thank you for telling me. Now, I want to know, didn't some of them actually go to, Gibraltar or Gibraltar was still part of, during that time frame, that was still part of Spain. But didn't some of them go into North Africa as well,
yes,
Ceuta and Melilla and all that, right?
Absolutely, absolutely,
okay.
Yes.
And
not
okay.
Just the Ottoman Empire. I neglected to say they also went to North Africa, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Rachel. And now we will hear from Gloria. So, Gloria, what would you like to add to this? What happened to these Jews?
Well, Rachel has given you really essentials. I'd like to add a few things that I think are interesting and important. One is going back to the expulsion to 1492. The Jews were, as you said, given the option of either converting to Catholicism if they wanted to stay or leaving Spanish lands, leaving Spain altogether. That's why we call it the expulsion. There was a third option if they did not convert to Catholicism, and they stayed in Spain as Jews, they were killed. And there were people who either chose that option or ended up like that.
So that's not a really good option.
Yeah.
Not a good option.
But it really brings home the seriousness of the expulsion.
Absolutely.
Also the expulsion. Yeah, something that always impressed me is that the edict of expulsion is so absolute, so all-inclusive. They really take care to say all Jews, children, men, women, maidservants, everyone has to go. So it's really a clean, like cleaning out the country, and that's really how they thought of it.
Cleaning out the country
of Jews.
Right.
So
and
that's
you know,
one thing.
Right. And I think that they wanted to clean out the country, not only of Jews, but of Muslims.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in southern Spain, where my family, maternal side, originates from, they tried to repopulate a lot of that area with people from Germany, which just, you know, that's kind of mind-boggling. But that's why you'll see some Spaniards that have from way, way, way back. You may look at them and you go, you know, where did they get their blue eyes and their blonde hair, et cetera, because these were not really people that were originally from Spain to begin with. They were not ethnically Spanish. They were descendants of German people that were, you know, so these people tried to repopulate. Let's try to repopulate Spain and clean out their bloodlines. But, you know, the beauty of that is this final thing. It didn't work. Because today there's still a lot of Spanish people with Jewish ancestry, Moorish ancestry, they have Gypsy ancestry, they have this and that. That's really what makes the Spanish people who they are. And so thank God that there's still many people that have that in their background, I being one. So anyway, now I want to know, while I still have you here with me too, I want to know what happened, Gloria, to their Judeo-Spanish.
What happened to the Judeo-Spanish? Yeah. Well, a little background on the Judeo-Spanish. The language, as you've indicated, is called Ladino, Judeo-Spanish, and Español even, which means Spanish. That's the way my parents used to refer to it, but it was no good because if you didn't know what we were talking about, you'd think we were talking about Spanish, regular. By the way, there's no completely satisfying name to everybody of the language. Anyway, it is based on 15th century Castilian Spanish, and there were elements of Hebrew and Arabic already in the language before the Jews left Spain. What happened? The language went with the people and was enriched by contact with languages and cultures in the lands the Sephardim resettled. Turkey, for instance, this is, as you indicated, my heritage, so I take examples from there. The word for handbag, for instance, the only word I know is çanta, and it's Turkish. Some Turkish elements I found out recently from a wonderful student of mine, a Ladino student of mine who knows Persian, of Persian descent himself. There are some Turkish elements that come from Arabic, but they go even further back to Persian. So that's fascinating that we have that also in our language. We have also a lot of Italian elements. The word for a grandmother, the usual word is nonna. The word for butt is ma, is in Italian. We have a lot of French, and this is not because we settled in France. There were some who settled in France, but because the schools of the Alliance Israélite Universelle, which was schools set up by French Jews who thought that the Middle Eastern Jews have to be civilized. That means made French. Civilization was French. So you have French, a lot of French in the language. And what happened as a result not only of the French influence, but also, a result of something much more momentous of the Holocaust, result also of the fact that in Israel they wanted to have one language to unite the Jews, Hebrew, and the other languages, the Jewish languages, were not encouraged. Because of all of these factors, there were fewer and fewer speakers, and the language is considered endangered. But I always say, and I tell students, Ladino is an endangered but flourishing language. Now, how can you be endangered and flourishing at the same time? But it's true. It's endangered because there were few dangerously few speakers. But it's flourishing because, well, first of all, there are always new speakers, and some of them are my own students. That's one thing. It's flourishing also because there are new songs and plays and comedies being written, poems, a lot of journalistic activity, a lot of academic that we'll do later. But what happened to it is that it is la lingua viva. It is a living language.
Right.
And it's developing further.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Well, thank you. And now we're going to hear from Rachel. Rachel? Are you there? I hope she's there. Rachel, are you there?
Oh, sorry. I have been speaking with my mute on.
No. That's okay. We want to know. So, again, the question was, and I know you've been listening.
I know you
so what
question.
Happened to the Judeo-Spanish? So, and Gloria gave us...
I want to stress, though, that the Jews in Spain, all over Spain, spoke the same language as everybody else around them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What the Jewish elements, the Hebrew elements that came, that were used, had to do with the religion.
Yes.
So the Judeo-Spanish, as we saw it, as we know it today, is as it evolved, as the medieval Spanish that our ancestors brought with them, was retained essentially, but as Gloria explained, incorporated the various influences. So what you said in the beginning, that that the language remained unchanged from medieval times, is not quite true. It did remain unchanged in its essence, in its grammar, in its pronunciation, vocalization, and so on. But it did evolve, as all living languages constantly do.
Absolutely.
And that Gloria explained very well as
yes,
how that happened. And
And, well, I think we'll talk about why it's endangered in a little while, right? So
yeah,
we'll
absolutely.
I'll add about that a little later.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
but what I find interesting is you made a comment, and see, this is something that I found out, and I think I've shared this with the whole group, but the listeners don't know this. Here, my grandparents were immigrants from Spain, and we used a word in my house, and I told you about this, but we used a word in my house, and we've used it for years, throwing up, vomiting, and we would say gomitar. And so I was with a cousin of mine not that long ago, and her father actually comes from Mexico. And she said to me, and her mom is Spanish, she said, but why are you saying that, you know? And I said, well, that's the way we say it, you know, that we've always said it at my house. And then I went back and I talked to my mom about it. I said to her, how do you say this word? And she said the same thing. The thing that is interesting to me, if this was an archaic word from a long, long time ago, you know, like say the 14th century or 15th century, because the Jews today that speak Ladino still say that word that way, my family still retained that word. And in Castilian, in current Castilian language, you would say vomitar with a V. But all these years, okay, all my 50 years on this earth, I've always said gomitar. I just found that really quite fascinating. And, you find out someone, you're 50 years old, and you're like, what? You know, so you mean I've been doing it, saying it wrong? Well, not necessarily. This is the way that my family said that word for years. And my family's from Andalusia, so.
May I add something to that?
Sure, sure.
And that is that medieval Spanish forms, which are very similar to Judeo-Spanish, can be found all over the Hispanic world, especially in isolated towns and so on, including in Spain, including in Mexico and South America and so on. So it is not unusual. Some of them may even have some Jewish ancestry, who knows, but not necessarily.
Right. Okay, so now we're going to go and speak about dialects. You know, dialects have always intrigued me. So now we're going to talk about dialects of Judeo-Spanish, Judeo-Español. So joining me for this will first off be Brian, and then we'll later hear from Rachel. So, Brian, welcome tonight.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
So the question is a very valid one and an interesting one. What I like best about the term, I know Gloria had mentioned it earlier, Judeo-Spanish, particularly, it seems like the term that kind of encapsulates all forms of this Ibero-Romance Jewish speech. So to answer your question, I believe certainly there are dialects of Judeo-Spanish. And, you know, if you look at, I guess, the particularities, then, you know, there's kind of an Eastern Judeo-Spanish, which is often referred to either as Ladino or even Judesmo. And then there's the Western Judeo-Spanish, which is the language that comes from those Sephardic Jews who went to North Africa and primarily Morocco, and that's known as Hakatia. So, and again, Judesmo, or the language that the Ladino spoken in the Ottoman Empire, can certainly be broken down even further into Southeastern and Northwestern, and differences between what is now the Ladino of Turkey or Greece. But again, you could even find differences, which I'm sure Rachel can speak to a lot more, within the same between Izmir and Istanbul. And what's interesting in itself is that the two major dialects of Judeo-Spanish, which can be seen as, you know, of the Ottoman or the Balkans and also of Morocco, also have very many similarities with one another, but also differences that kind of distinguish themselves. The language or dialect Hakatia certainly has a much more prevalent Arabic influence, or essentially even Moroccan Arabic, Darija, influence from them. And then there are many more sounds that are attributed to Arabic, kind of crossing over into their Hakatia, Judeo-Spanish language. But what is common to both, to all dialects actually, of Judeo-Spanish is some of these forms which we think of archaic, but they are the forms that really were shared by the peninsula, Spain, before the expulsion. And those are things, obviously, that all dialects of Judeo-Spanish share, whether they be a word like dicho, which in obviously modern Spanish or Castilian would be dijo, and that's common in Hakatia and Judesmo and other sounds maybe that are so unique to Judeo-Spanish today, like ijo, which obviously would be hijo. But again, there's so many dialectal differences in Judeo-Spanish where a word like son, ijo, you can have in one place being pronounced as ijo, another place being pronounced as fijo, another place as fiju, iju. So there's certainly many different dialects within Judeo-Spanish. Mm-hmm. And I certainly encourage anyone listening to log on or to go on YouTube. You know, the National Authority of Ladino, located in Jerusalem, has a variety of YouTube videos with speakers from all of these places that we're talking about today, and you can hear the differences and see at the end really how related they are, and I guess the intelligibility between them.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. And you know, I think one thing I want to touch on is, and Rachel touched on this, and she did a really great job in explaining this, to understand, and for listeners to understand, the Spanish that they're speaking, even though archaic in sound, and maybe even the dialects, are really not that different than what was being spoken during that time. It was the same thing. And still, Brian, to this day, you will find dialects within Spain where the J, a dialect or even a language outside of Castilian, outside of Castellano, be it Catalan or Gallego or some of the other ones, where that J would be pronounced more of a J sound. So it's still in existence, but probably not in the norm of regular Castilian Spanish. So thank you for sharing that, and now we're going to hear from Rachel. I think Rachel might have her mute button on. Are you there?
Yeah.
That's okay.
Sorry, you have to keep reminding me.
That's all right, I will.
Sorry.
No, that's great. I mean, I'm glad you're doing that.
Yes.
So we're talking about the dialect
what
of
I want to
Spanish.
Add to this youngest of the group, that is Brian, and we're so happy that people like Brian are learning our language and are so excited and in love with it, sharing our own love of the language, that I just want to add a few things. And that is to mention the effect of the printing press in standardizing Ladino so that everybody could, in the Sephardic world, could read the same books. Even in North Africa, with Hakatia having evolved so differently, even in the 18th century, when the printing press started to produce works in Judeo-Spanish, especially one set of books of commentaries on the Bible, called the Me'am Loez, which was totally in Judeo-Spanish but written or printed in Hebrew characters. Those books traveled to North Africa. So, I mean, and all over the Ottoman world that was Judeo-Spanish speaking. So that has to had a very sort of standardizing influence, the printing press. Later, of course, that turned into daily and weekly papers and serialized novels and everything else. Our language was printed in Hebrew characters, specifically the Judeo-Spanish preferred to use the what is called the Rashi alphabet, which is a form I don't want to go into what that is now, but that is why today when people see a text in Ladino, they will be surprised as to how we spell it so phonetically that people think it's strange. If we want to say disho, which means he or she said, we will spell it D-I-S-H-O. Because we, having been separated from Spain for five centuries, we had no idea how we were supposed to either pronounce or spell a word.
Mm-hmm.
So since it was spelled until the turn of the 20th century, at least,
mm-hmm.
in Hebrew characters,
mm-hmm.
we just pretty much phonetically transposed the Hebrew characters into Latin characters. And so we developed a slightly different way of spelling even familiar words that Spaniards would recognize.
Mm-hmm. Now I have a question for you, Rachel. That being mm-hmm. said, say those Jews that traveled to the Netherlands,
mm-hmm.
or they were in Morocco,
mm-hmm.
or they were in Algeria, wherever they went to that was in closer approximation to where Spain was, or were they more, would they have spelt it like you would be spelling it now, or would they have been influenced more by modern Spanish evolving?
Let me tell you about North Africa first, and that is that they were very much influenced by the evolution of the Peninsular Spanish.
Okay.
So they are more apt to write Spanish in that way.
I see.
As to those who went to Holland and or the Netherlands, they were by and large coming from Portugal. In fact, in the 16th, 17th century in the Netherlands, Portuguese was synonymous with Jewish,
mm-hmm.
and they spoke Spanish and Portuguese, but very soon they integrated to the, they lost that language. In other words, they did not keep their Spanish for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So today there is no dialect, let's say, of Judeo-Spanish from those countries, from Holland and England and so on.
Mm-hmm. You know, interestingly, thank you for sharing that. Interestingly, I went on YouTube, and folks out there in the audience, this is, you know, if you get on the internet and you just go onto Google and type in Ladino, go into videos, you can hear actually the language being spoken. What I found really interesting was that different people, even from maybe within the same country, like say in the Ottoman Empire, when they're speaking Ladino, speak it very differently. So, and I want to give you an idea of what I'm saying. When you and I spoke, Rachel, I completely understood about 95% of what you said. I've heard other people on YouTube that may be from Turkey and they're speaking in Ladino, and I'm like, what? I didn't understand that. I've heard different types of accents. So that's kind of interesting to me, because you would think mm-hmm. that maybe within an area,
mm-hmm.
People would speak very similar, you know. But that may not necessarily be the case.
That's correct. Am I to answer that?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. That is correct. Even when Ladino was the language, as I said, I was born into that language. Everybody in my neighborhood spoke it, and in my town, all the Jews spoke it. That was the language. Even then, there were differences. It depended on people's education. It depended depended on how much Hebrew they knew. A rabbi's Spanish would sound so different than a street vendor's Spanish. I mean, the rabbi would use more Hebrew words and so on. My aunt, who was illiterate, my eldest aunt, spoke almost a pure Spanish. I mean, we had, in most of us had integrated the French word for butter, for example. We called it beurre. Well, she called it manteca. You know?
Right.
And we used to say bonjour, bonsoir. She used to say buenos dias. Buenas tardes, nochada buena, whatever, you know. There are differences. There's also differences in intonation. I mean, a language is a sum total of a lot of things. And so everybody assumes things sometimes from their family, from their background, from their education, whatever.
Uh-huh.
My nature is to speak slowly. I don't speak fast. But some other people have the nature of speaking very fast. So that also makes a difference. And also the subject matter of what we're talking about. If we're talking about shopping and I tell you, voy a tomar la chanta y me voy a ir a desmerzar y no sé cuál. If I'm speaking with Gloria, maybe you won't understand as much as you understood when I was speaking directly to you. So I was a teacher of English as a second language for 35 years. So I know how I am a little conscious of, are they going to understand me, you know?
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, and let me share something. Even within the Spanish language, as you know, there's a lot of words that if you're from Spain, you would use that don't necessarily mean the same thing in Latin America. And they may have a different, they may mean something totally, totally different. And so you're like, wow, you know. So it's interesting it's interesting with the story about what you were talking about your eldest aunt, and I believe that's what you said, right? Your eldest aunt, and what she would say, and which is very much the same as you would say in standard Spanish. So thank you for sharing that. Now I want to go to a question that I find really interesting, and that is, why is Ladino listed as one of the endangered languages by UNESCO? And so I'm going to have Brian start on this, and then we'll get back to Rachel.
Sure, thanks. So UNESCO is the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, and just to clarify on UNESCO. I think this question actually is one that listeners everywhere can really relate to. So when I was thinking about this question, I was thinking back to, most times when you're in school or with friends, maybe when you were younger, you might have had to list or maybe list all of the 50 states or even countries in the world or things like that. So I would actually ask listeners to take a second to think of how many languages there are. To think of how many languages there are in the world. And again, language or dialect, we won't get into that. And then see how many languages you could actually name. I personally, have not counted all of the languages, but there are certainly different counts by organizations that say that there are over 6,500 different different languages in the world. And how many can we actually name will come down to the most prevalence, the most common with the most speakers, et cetera. So really, most languages in the world are, in essence, endangered. And to be an endangered language really comes down to who is speaking the language and, I guess, the vitality itself of the language. There are also different estimates and different paradigms as to, you know, what does it mean to be a language, an endangered language, and to what level, severe, moderate, etc. But really, this is something that most language communities face in the world, where more than the current estimate that is kind of seen in most books and among most people is that most languages today are endangered and will be really extinct by the end of this century. So the fundamental question that I think when I think of, well, what's an endangered language and why is Ladino an endangered language, really comes down to the following. Are there children speaking the language? And that's obviously, I think, something that's very important to keep in mind, because when you think of a language, the only way that the language will continue is being passed on from generation to generation, and that obviously has to go down to children or youth who are going to be able to take this language and pass it on to following generations. Mm-hmm. Now, Ladino obviously has had such, over the course of, you know, the 500 years in the diaspora, has had such movement and history, and as Rachel and Gloria mentioned earlier, really you could see the entire history in the language, as in most languages when you really look at it. So there's obviously events that have really taken a hit and made Ladino become an endangered language. Obviously the Holocaust being one of them, but something, again, not only for Ladino. So really the main reason that Ladino is an endangered language today is that because there are not communities that are speaking the language today as their first language. There are no speakers today of Ladino whose only language is Ladino. That's to say, so there's no monolingual of Ladino, somebody who can only speak Ladino and can use that language and no other language, just because there's no completely, it's not the society we live in today. And then that can also be said for children. There aren't, unfortunately, communities of children speaking the language. So that's really, I guess, what it comes down to, really.
That's interesting, because now, see, I, while you were talking and while you were saying that, I was thinking, like, say, Spanish, right? So you can't say the same thing about Spanish, because there's still people that's their only language, right?
Sure.
That's the only language that they speak. They may not pass that on to their children, but there are people that's their first and only language. But what I did relate to was the fact that within my ethnic heritage, Spanish people, that their families are from Spain, I think that they would fit kind of in that same boat with Ladino, because what's happening is they do not maintain the culture they don't maintain the language as well as other people that speak Spanish. Does that make sense? So I have quite a few cousins that cannot speak Spanish at all. Or if they do, English. and if they do speak Spanish, it's very little. And let me share something really quick with you, a quick story, and then we're going to hear from I believe, Rachel. But a quick story is that there is a cookie that we make during holiday time called mantecados, okay? And so the word manteca for butter. And being that my family's from southern Spain, we say mantecados. And so you would still spell it mantecados, okay, mantecados. But my mom's cousin, when she was writing out the recipe, she doesn't speak Spanish. Do you know how she spelt it? She spelt it mantecaos, mantecaos. And I'm telling my mom, what are these? And she says, and she laughs, she says, those are mantecados. And I said, those are mantecados? I said, but see, they didn't maintain the Spanish language, right? And so when she's writing it out, she's writing it out totally different. So I can see where, you know, within my group of people, that's happening as well, you know, because there's
And
there are not people that are really speaking that Spanish is their only language within the Spanish community. That Spanish is their only. Yeah, it's funny. So anyway, thank you, bro.
Yeah, sure.
No, go ahead.
No, I think that that's something that also, obviously, Ladino might be a new topic to many, you know, to many of the listeners, but that's something not only, obviously, in America, but, you know, you gave a great example with the Spanish, and
right.
at least with the Spanish in the United States, and even with Ladino, too, that's something that so much of what why languages become endangered really have to do with politics at the end of the day, and, you know, what
uh-huh.
is the language of power where you live. And so many Ladino speakers, for very many reasons, gave up the Ladino language to speak this language of their nation. And that's something we find even in the United States with speakers of Spanish or whose family, parents and grandparents speak Spanish. We see so
right.
many stories where children are saying, let me speak English and forget
right.
about Spanish. And
right.
that's something that, you know, you can maintain both, and you can have Spanish and English, and you can have English and Ladino. And that's something that I really hope, you know, more people take, you know, consciousness of, because that's really important. And one way to kind of fight back towards, you know, putting these languages in an endangered state, because you never know where the language will be in another generation or so.
Yeah. And you know, it's great, Brian, that you're really kind of helping to keep that language alive and what you're doing. So that's wonderful, because I think that that's something that really – a lot of people would just applaud you on. There needs to be more people that say, you know, I'm going to be responsible. This is why we're doing this program here tonight, and which is part one of a two-part series, and which also, by the way, was staff picked by the network to go throughout the whole network. That this, and I think it's a wonderful thing. This show will be seen and heard of by all people that go onto the network, because the network felt it was that strong and that important to get the message out. So, you know, we all do our part. So I think it's wonderful the work that you're doing. So thank you very much for sharing. And now I'm going to ask Rachel to chime in on this. And you can take your phone off mute.
Thank you. I did. I want to say that you gave very good examples about how the a person wants to speak the language of the country that she or he lives in, and that causes loss of a language. However, the big difference between standard Spanish, let's say, what we call Espanol today, and Ladino is that there are entire countries, and Brian alluded to the politics. It's said that the language is a language only if it has a flag to be under. In other words, if it has a nation that speaks it. And but we, the Sephardic Jews, are dispersed all over the world, and we each speak the language of the country that we are in. Like, again, to reiterate what Brian said, there is no monolingual Ladino speaker today, living today.
Really?
Yes, there isn't. And number two is there are no children who speak it. The closest thing we have so far as children is a choral group in Istanbul dedicated to singing Ladino songs, a children's choral group. And they sing it very well with very authentic speech accent, but they go home and they speak Turkish, you know.
Okay.
And that is the problem. We don't have a community. We don't have boundaries within which, you know, there are no ghettos anymore, and so on. So that causes, and as you know, Ashkenazi people will say that the same thing about Yiddish disappearing that way. But anyway, that's another subject.
Well, so here's my question. My question is this: when did Ladino really became where it was started to go, what, you know, many feared as being extinct? Because, again, you know, you're not that old. You were born in Turkey. That was your language, and I'm sure it survived. It survived all these years, over 500 years.
Yes,
right.
It is my generation
now
that killed it.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And why do you think
that is? Sorry for interrupting. But
No. Why do you think that is? That's very interesting. I want to know why do you think that is.
Yes. In the case of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, it started disintegrating, first of all. In the reason that we were able to maintain the language for 500 years is because of the makeup of the Ottoman Empire, where each ethnic group, it was so vast and it contained within it so many ethnic groups that it was administered by allowing each ethnic, which was really religious ethnic community, religion-based ethnic community, to speak its own language, have its own schools, have its own courts, and so on, hospitals and all that kind of thing. So they used their own language for this self-administration within the empire. So this allowed the Jews to have as their language the Spanish language, what we call the Espanol, but of course it was Ladino. So, but in 1920, when the empire disintegrated at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, then all these nationalities came into being. In the case of Turkey, it was in 1923, and each forced its citizens, and the citizens who probably wanted to also become part of that nation and had to speak those languages and so on. And so I was educated. I didn't know Turkish until really I started going to school. And but then Turkish became a better language. So even at home, very often I would speak to my brother in Turkish and to everybody else in Spanish. So slowly, you know, so my generation, when they had children, the children didn't hear much Spanish, so they were going to Turkish schools. And so the language just disappeared that way because it wasn't used anymore.
Interesting.
So now I'm in America, and I really found out what a treasure we had in our language, and so that's why I formed Ladino Comunità, and that's another subject, I guess.
Yes, yes. Okay, so that's a great segue into my next question, and I know you're going to join me on this, Rachel, as well. But what is being done today to save the Ladino language? So, Brian, why don't you chime in on that one, and then we're going to hear from Rachel at the end again.
Sure. Well, mucho, so much. You know, every day I am learning of more and more efforts going on to save Ladino. But, you know, the one thing that I think here, you know, save a language, really, what does that mean? And there are two things that come to mind for me. And one is preservation, and another one is revitalization. So, you know, when we're speaking about saving a language, I think we have to kind of take into account, you know, these two factors. And as far as preserving and revitalizing, which do in many ways work hand in hand, there really is a lot. And Rachel mentioned, I believe, the Estreikas de Istanbul, you know, the children singing group in Turkey. And then there's Ladino, which we'll speak about later, at different universities for college students to learn the language. But then there's also documentation in really every form, from books to documentaries to music to workshops, cultural programs, films, film festivals, even excursions to, you know, Sephardic sites and communities, or what was also mentioned before, really newspapers and journals that still continue to this day. So these are things that certainly help to both preserve and revitalize. You know, I'm focused often on this kind of revitalizing agenda, I guess, because I think that what's important is to get the interest of youth, of younger generations, to really speak towards the language and to use the language. And later I'll speak of my own group here at UCLA. But what I'm also seeing is really this great interest in Ladino, not only among youth, but also among professors, and also really young professors, new young, you know, professors who are really saying that, you know, this is really the first time in all these generations that this group has really had to learn Ladino in many ways from scratch, in this kind of exterior, non-Ottoman type of atmosphere. So, you know, many, you know, people wanting to learn the language have to kind of take it into their own hands and go about it proactively. So I really see a lot of collaborating going on right now, and I think that will certainly help to kind of revitalize the language.
I see.
What was touched upon a bit was clearly technology, mm-hmm. and that's something that obviously, not, you know, Ladino or any language really in a similar predicament
right.
will be something that really is leading the force, whether it be, you know, random groups on you know, web pages or Facebook, or even Ladino Comunità, which I'll, you know, obviously let Rachel speak to
right.
Right. as the founder of that.
Right. Well, that's wonderful. I'm kind of interested, and thank you, Brian, for sharing. What you said made me start thinking down the road of another, I think, something that can tie in really well here, and I'm going to ask Rachel to answer this. Okay, so the question was, what is being done to save the Ladino language? We know, like in Brian's case, his background is not necessarily Sephardic, but he had a very strong interest in this, and then he also speaks Spanish. So what I want to know is, in the saving and preservation of this language, how many people, how many Sephardic Jews or children of Sephardic Jews? Now, I don't know if there are children to this day that, or younger people like in their 20s or 30s, where both parents might be Sephardic, so that child is really, I mean, they're Sephardic. How many of those people are holding on or wanting to hold on to their culture, learn the language, versus outsiders? And that's kind of what I want to know. Is there an interest level on people that their families are Sephardic, but they didn't? Like, for instance, Sarah Aroeste, she's a singer, and we know, and hopefully we're going to have her on part two where she'll share some of her music. But here's a prime example. I think her grandparents on one side were Turkish Sephardic Jews from Turkey. Am I right or wrong? Correct me if I'm right or wrong. But I know she's Sephardic. But the point is that here is somebody, here's a young woman that has shown interest in the language and now is singing songs and writing songs in Ladino. So I'm wondering how many people that have that in their background are saying, you know what, maybe my parents didn't speak it or they lost the language, but I want to learn it. Rachel?
Yes. Unfortunately, I wish I had an optimistic answer to that. What I'm seeing from the membership of Ladino Comunità is that more of the young people, or most of the young people who are interested and, in fact, in love with our language, are not of Sephardic background and sometimes not even of Jewish background at all. But there are some. Recently, I attended a conference in Austin of the Latin American Jewish Studies Association. And there were some younger, you know, in the 30s, academics there from Latin America and Cuba and so on, whose parents spoke Ladino. You know, it's in the Spanish-speaking countries, it's very easy to lose your Ladino because it's so close to Spanish.
Spanish, right.
But they were just fascinated with the subject of Ladino, and they came to me and told me how I reminded them of their grandparents and so on, and a couple of them, subscribed to the publication in Istanbul called El Amanecer. I had one to show them what it was like and so on. So yes, there are, and I also want to mention the importance of music. There are many, many people writing new songs. Gloria is one of them, by the way. She's on. But just now, what is more amazing to me is that Sephardic people are scattered literally all over the world. In Ladino Comunità, we have 44 countries represented.
Wow, that's amazing.
And just today, I got an email from a young man called Yair Sapir, who lives in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a Sephardic music group, and he writes new Ladino songs or takes new Ladino poetry and composes music to that.
Wow,
to it.
Good for him.
And I'm going to send you later the links. If your listeners want to see, I mean, there is so much of Ladino music on the internet. They should just go and listen. It's thriving with new, but that doesn't translate, unfortunately, to speaking the language or making the children speak it.
Yes.
And at this point, we don't care, and we not that only at this point. Normally, we wouldn't care who is learning to speak it, just so long as they learn it. And whatever they want to do with it, they want to sing with it, they want to write with it, they want to write about it.
Right,
whatever.
Right.
This Sephardic writer from Mexico, who has a wonderful new book called Tela de Cebolla, and she includes a lot of Ladino in her book, and that book has won awards recently. She said, what we can do really is preserve the memory of Ladino. Well, I think we can do even a little better than that, and that is continue the creativity in the language. And whether we speak it daily or not. May I say something about Ladino Comunità, because we've been mentioning it? It is one of these online groups under Yahoo Groups, where we correspond only in Ladino. And we have now 1,460-some members, as I said, from all over the world. And some of them are Sephardic Jews. Some of them are Spanish-speaking people who were raised Catholic or other Christian and discovered or suspect that they had Jewish ancestry and they want to learn and reconnect with people of Sephardic origin and their language. And some of them are academics that are studying our literature or whatever. So we have a varied group of people, and it's very exciting because there Ladino lives just like it lives in Gloria's classes. Gloria teaches it as a living language because there are many places that teach it as a language of the past,
to study the old texts
and so on.
Right.
So.
Wow, that's great. Well, I'm looking at the time. It's unbelievable to me that we've already been on here 70 minutes.
Oh.
And and unfortunately, we're not even really we've touched on a few things, and we're probably going to have to move through a little bit quicker. But you know, the next thing I want to talk about is, and I think I'm going to have Dolores join me. Dolores is going to come back. But in the USA and Canada, do we know where the highest concentration of the Sephardi have lived? And Dolores and Rachel are going to touch on this. But Dolores, I haven't heard from you for a while, so I'm going to bring you back on.
Well, I just want to say that I'm really enjoying myself listening to my colleagues and learning a lot. Before I answer that question, I just want to just expand a little bit on what Rachel said. She mentioned a publication called El Amanecer, which comes out of Turkey, out of Istanbul, and it's in Ladino. It's published once a month by the Jewish community of Istanbul, and they publish a weekly publication in Turkish, and once a month they include Eleman Aser, which is in Ladino. And so that is one way to nurture the Ladino speakers in Turkey. So after having said that, I'll move on and answer the question that has been assigned to me. If we want to look at the concentration of where the Sephardim have lived, I think we have to look at how they got to where they settled in the U.S. and in Canada. And the very first colony of Sephardim in the U.S., I think, can date back to 1598 in what is now northern New Mexico, when an expedition was led by Oñate to the area north of Santa Fe of people from what is now Mexico, and this was the northern edge of New Spain, the Spanish colony in the northern part of the New World. And they settled there. Now, they were mostly, many of them were converted from Judaism. They were Catholics converted from Judaism. And we're discovering today that many of them are noticing their ancestry. They're becoming aware of this, that they had thought that their families had been Catholic and that they had been from old Spanish blood, and now they're discovering that their ancestors had indeed been Sephardic Jews. So I have to point to them first, because even though many of them don't even know about this and know that's their history, it is a reality that maybe 65% of the people of Hispanic background whose ancestors settled in northern New Mexico and southern Colorado in the late, in the 16th and 17th centuries were descended from converted Jews or Sephardic Jews. And these folks have been given the label of crypto-Jews, meaning hidden Jews, because in some cases they practiced Judaism in secret. So that's the first group of Sephardim I want to call attention to in the United States. And
okay. Well, that's so, wonderful.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And so they're primarily, so again, are they seen primarily in just certain states? Or are we seeing them, are they being, like, say, for instance, these crypto Jews, are they being seen in, like, say, places like Texas and Colorado and within the United States and maybe
yes.
Arizona and New Mexico and, you know, places
yes.
like that?
Yes. Yes, definitely. Along along the Texas-Mexico border, for example, many Tejanos have this background, people whose ancestors settled there, supposedly directly from Spain,
mm-hmm.
and they're finding that out, too. And then in New England, in Massachusetts and Rhode Island,
mm-hmm.
we have concentrations of people of this background, people who go into their cellars in the on Friday evenings as a family and light candles. And when you ask them why they do it, they just look at you and say, well, we've always done it. And they're not even aware that this is a Sephardic custom that carried over long after people in the family forgot who their ancestors were. So you do have that. Now, that we're talking about this one particular population.
Uh-huh.
And then, so that, I would say, was the earliest concentration of Sephardim Mm-hmm. And then we look at 1624, when the chief of converted Jews from Portugal were fleeing from Brazil because Brazil had been recaptured by the Portuguese. It had been in the hands of the Dutch, and these Jews had settled in Amsterdam, had fled from Portugal, where they felt persecuted, and had settled in Amsterdam. And then, when the Dutch had control of Brazil, they went to Brazil to live, and then they were able to return to Judaism. And then when the Portuguese took it over, the Portuguese tried to force them to go back to Christianity. And so this this ship of refugees was fleeing from from Brazil, actually from Recife. And they got blown off course, and they ended up, most people know this, they ended up outside of what is now New York. It was then New Amsterdam. And after much convincing, Peter Stuyvesant, the governor, allowed them to land. How he was convinced would take up too much time, so I won't go into that. But they were the very first settlement on the East Coast of Jews. And what's so interesting is that they formed a Jewish congregation named Shiaret Israel, which is still in existence.
Right.
It's called the Spanish and Portuguese Synagogue, and my cousins were married there. So it's still a venerable community. And if you walk in New York, every now and then you'll come across a vestige of this that's remarkable. I was walking on West 11th Street in New York City once, and I noticed a fence that was around looked like a real empty little area. And when I looked in, there was this tiny triangle of land. And I noticed tombstones. And then I saw a plaque, and it said that this was one of the first burial grounds of Sephardic Jews from that Jewish congregation. And that's right on West 11th Street, and you can just walk right by it and see it. There's still vestiges there.
Right. So it would be fair to say, in the United States at least, too, a real high concentration of the Sephardi really lived in New York. I mean, there was a big concentration of those people in New York. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
New York is first. That's right.
Yeah.
It has
the
biggest population.
Yeah.
And then
thank you. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You say that right after New York comes Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
Then Seattle, and then Miami. And
okay.
I really there was time for me to tell you about Seattle, because that's just a precious story, how it was settled and how the Sephardic Jews became a very important part of the Seattle community.
Okay. And
I know we're short of time, so
So we can catch. Remind me that we can do that on the next show, because that I think that's very, very interesting. We have a lot of friends up in Seattle. This would be a wonderful another topic. So, and thank you, Dolores. And for the sake of time, I'm going to ask Rochelle I'm going to ask three people to answer the next question. Okay. So, and I want Rochelle to answer. The question first, Rachel. I want you to answer this question first, and then Dolores, and then Gloria. Are these people really Spanish people?
Okay, so Rachel's first. Rachel.
Rachel, okay. You're first.
Me?
You have to
mute. Okay.
That's that's great. That's the word for the day. Mute. Okay.
First of all, we think of ourselves as Jews, not as Spaniards. But we are very, very conscious of our Spanishness. And we can't escape it because we spoke Spanish for 500 years, wherever we were. And we have, many of us have Spanish last names. I mean, my maiden name is Amado. I mean, we have Cordova, De Leon, De Toledo, Toledano, Navarro, Rodriguez, Cardozo, Señor, Ventura, Sevilla, whatever. We have so many Spanish last names among the Sephardic Jews from the Ottoman Empire, and not to mention, of course, those that are descendants of the other, the so-called Western Sephardim, that from Holland and so on, that came to Brazil, like
surnames.
We are very conscious of our Spanish roots. And the Spanish government decided that we are Spanish people recently and is giving us the option of getting Spanish citizenship. In fact, even Portugal decided that Sephardic Jews deserve to come back to Portugal as full citizens of Portugal. We ourselves know about Spanish ancestry, but after 500 years, we don't feel like we are Spanish unless we go to Spain and then we see how similar we are to everybody there in looks and gestures and everything, in food.
Were you amazed? I mean, the first time you went to Spain, you and I have talked about this, but the listeners have not heard about it. So you heard these stories, and I'm sure, you know, for instance, Gloria's heard the stories too, but you heard these stories of, you know, we were once from Spain, blah, blah, blah. But when you went there, what happened? Mm-hmm. Was it unreal to you? I mean, was it just like, were you just completely in shock when you were there and you're like, oh my gosh.
Let me tell you a joke. I mean, it's not a joke. It's actually happened.
Tell me a joke.
It's sort of funny. That in Istanbul there was a Jewish taxi driver, and Spanish language was it was known as Jewish in Turkish. I mean, Yahudija means Jewish. So it was the Jewish language, and only Jews spoke Spanish in Turkey. So when the Jewish taxi driver got in the back, a couple of Spanish priests that happened to be traveling in Istanbul, and they started to talk Spanish, he turns around and says, "Ah, judios sois vosotros." That means, "Are you Jewish?" Because
that is amazing. That's funny.
There are all kinds of similar stories of grandmothers in the United States who would say, "Don't marry an Ashkenazi Jew. Find yourself a good Spanish man." So people had this imagination that Spanish equals Jewish.
And you know, to your point, you and I spoke about this. I told you of a friend of mine whose mother is from Greece. And I was sharing with her, and I know, Rachel, that you spent time, you lived in Greece as well. But, you know, I shared with her that there were Spanish Jews in Greece, and she just argued with me and said, "No, there were not. There were no Spanish Jews in Greece." And I said, "Well, yes, they were in Greece, and they spoke Ladino, and they had their own community." No, they spoke Jewish, you know, they spoke, so that's to your point of what you said. they did not consider that Spanish, they considered that Jewish because they tied in the religion of a people to their tongue. So, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. So, and now I'm wondering, Dolores, can you chime in here about what your thoughts are if these people really are Spanish people?
Well, yes, I will. I think that we have to look at it that that identity can be very mixed, For example, Rachel and I have a friend whose family comes from Rhodes, the island of Rhodes. But before that, they came from Spain, like Rachel's family. Then at the time of the expulsion, they went to the Ottoman Empire and settled in Salonika, and then, which is Salonika, it's now Thessalonica in Greece. And then the Sultan moved his family and others from Salonika to Rhodes because he had just gotten hegemony over it and he wanted it to prosper. So he picked these Sephardic families, knowing that they were very skilled in a lot of things and they would make his new colony prosper. Well, today, people from Rhodes make up a large portion of my friend's synagogue, and there is much an identity with Rhodes as they are with their ancestry in Spain.
I see.
So I need to say that while everyone acknowledges that they have roots in Spain, they also have identities elsewhere that developed through the centuries. And
sure.
And we have to honor that.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, and even for me, I remember, you know, even though I was raised in this culture, not in Ladino or Sephardic culture, but in Spanish culture, but very similar. And when, you know, I'm hearing about Spain and blah, 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 when I went there, it was like it was an unbelievable experience for me because it was something that I heard about, but it was like so distant. Do you know what I'm saying? It was like it was like an old story, you know? But then when I was there and I was walking around, I'm like, oh, my gosh, these people look like me, you know? And
yeah.
and not only do they look like me, they walk like me, they talk like me. and it was funny because here in the United States, you know, people will say, oh, you look Mediterranean, but they don't know where to place you. You know, you don't quite look this, you don't quite. But when you go over there, people look so much like you that you feel, you know, you feel very comfortable. So anyway, now I'm wondering, Gloria, if you're still there, if you could chime in
about that.
And chime in what you think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I just wanted to say the way Dolores said, this has been so rich and I've learned so much, but I want to also get something. Before I start in on the identity, and I have quite a bit to say on that, but I'll say it briefly, I want to contribute something positive to the whole issue of younger people learning Ladino, younger Sephardim learning Ladino. I have, for instance, in my classes, two twin boys, these college students, both of them identifying as Sephardic, their mother and their grandma. I got to know the mother. I got to know the grandmother. They're from Izmir also, of all things, so we feel really close. They both understood Ladino when they came into my class, and now they can speak. And they are vowing to really continue. They want to teach other people, and so there is at least one example, and I hope there will be others. So that's what I wanted to say on that.
Mm-hmm.
With the question of Spanish identity, I agree that I too have multiple identities. I'm definitely, and when Dolores was speaking, I thought of this. I'm definitely Jewish. And when Rachel was saying also, I'm definitely Turkina, which means a Sephardic Jew from Turkey. And even more specifically, I fancy myself as Izmirliya del Bronx. I'm an Izmir woman from the Bronx. So that's really mixed up, you know. But are these people really Spanish? When I thought of it, my first impression was if living hundreds of years in a country and contributing to its culture count, then we are Spanish. Some people identify as Hispanic. I do. On the United States Census, for instance, I always check Hispanic, and then I have to go to other because, of course, Sephardic isn't listed, and then I explain the whole thing. And I explained, so if anyone reads that, they've learned something, you know?
Right.
But I really do feel Hispanic. The
right.
recognition of Spain came as something very welcome, even though there are difficulties in implementing that. But I think it's very nice that they welcome that. I have some personal experiences that made me feel even more Spanish. When I was in Spain, I had the same experiences as you had, Joey. I was walking through the streets of Madrid at night, yes, and I had this strange feeling that everyone looked like me. And I've never had that before. I was always the odd person out, you know.
Right.
I always looked different. And just hearing the language, which is so similar, they are, as I like to say, lenguas hermanas, they're sister
right.
languages. My feeling was made even more poignant in the bus station in Granada, of all places, in the cafeteria.
Uh-huh.
We wanted to eat something. I'm vegetarian, so I told them, put whatever verduras, whatever vegetables on the plate. And, you know, and I thought, it's going to be not the best meal in the world, but what you're going to do? You got to eat
right.
something. They handed me the plate, and the plate looked like something my mother had cooked. The way it was arranged, the vegetables themselves, the manner of preparing the vegetables. I'm not one to cry, but I almost did. My mother was no longer alive at that time. And my mother always used to say, "We are from Spain. We are from Spain." And I thought she was a little off. I mean, I knew I was from the Bronx. I don't know about her. And she was never in Spain. She never went back. She never went back. But then I thought of that when I saw that play to say, yeah, we are from Spain. We are. We always had the feeling of closeness in the subway when my mother or I or my father would hear someone speaking Spanish. We would just smile and think, yeah, one of us. We knew it wasn't a Sephardic Jew. We didn't think that. But we have this bond through the language. When we had new neighbors, people started coming into the Bronx from Puerto Rico, from the Dominican Republic, from
right.
Spanish-speaking places, and my
right.
mother was so glad. She said, finally, there's people who speak a language like ours, you know. The other Jews ran away. They ran away. They said, oh, no, what's going on here? We're being invaded, you know. My mother was so happy.
Invaded.
Yeah, that's how they felt. That's how they felt. We were so happy. It's all gone.
You know, this is a great segue into my next question. So you were talking about food. I want to talk about that. I want you to stay on here, Gloria, because I want to ask you about that, because you are going to talk about that, and Dolores is going to come on and talk about culture and customs. But I remember not that long ago, my cousin's cousin married a girl from Israel, and, you know, her family were Sephardic. Her mom and dad are Sephardic. So we went to the wedding. In fact, I wore a yarmulke over my, you know, and they're like, oh, my God, you look so Jewish, you know, they couldn't believe. Anyway, so it was really interesting because when I was in line to, now, her father was from Morocco, mother's from Algeria. When I was in line to get the food that they had prepared, they made the salad. And it was the same salad that my family makes. And I know it sounds crazy, but it's made out of bell peppers, and it's roasted bell peppers. And it was almost identical to what we make. And I'm like, and she said, Joey, you look like you're in shock. And I said, the salad is what we do. And see, we do the same, it's the same salad. And, you know, it was kind of like the same thing I got when I had a friend that was from Palestine. He was Christian, Arab. But we were sharing during holiday season, him and his wife. She was American, but, of course, he was from, I think he was from Jerusalem, actually. So anyway, and he said, oh, I've got to give you some Arabic cookies. And I'm not kidding you. This actually happened. And I said, oh, okay. He said, and his wife said, yeah, she, Johnny's been doing this all day long. So I said, well, we made our traditional cookies, so I want to give these to you guys too, okay? So you can imagine we're both looking at each other. These are like little baskets of cookies that are enclosed, and we each give them to each other, and we open them up at the same time, and guess what? They were the same cookie.
The same. Yeah.
Exactly. Those were those mantecados I was telling you about, and we put sesame seeds on top of them. And
it's biscochitos.
They're like, oh my gosh!
Maybe they're biscochitos.
Yeah, and then we make these other things called rosquetillos that are round, circular, like donuts, and they're with powdered sugar, and some people put anise, and they put, you know, sesame seeds and whatever. And so, so you know, they were just floored. So this is why I'm so interested about the food. Now, so you talked about, so tell me about, and I know, like you guys have, we do during the holidays, membrillo, which is quince. And I think the Ladino call it bembrillo.
Bembrillo.
Yeah. So it's the same thing, which is quince, which is great. Tell me some other stuff that you, bumuelos you make as well, right?
Yeah. Well, in our family, we make bimuelos, B-I-M.
Bimuelos.
Bimuelos.
Okay.
It's a little different from the bumuelos that are made for Hanukkah. I know about that through the songs and the things like that, but we never made them. We make, and I still make, bimuelos, and those are a special delicacy for Pesach, for Passover. They're made of, I don't know if this is what you mean, but this is what bimuelos are for me. You soak the masa. You soak the masa, squeeze it good. My mother always said no water should remain, you know, real squeeze the masa. You add a beaten egg or as many as you think. We don't have any. It's to taste everything. You know, you do it the way it's right, you know.
Yeah.
So a beaten egg and a lot of Romano cheese. It should be Kashkaval, but there is no good Kashkaval in this country now. There used to be in New York around the corner, the Boyero, a special Sephardic grocer, but we don't have. So Romano is the best, but I always say if you want to make them, put what you think is right and do it maybe three times over. Has to be a lot of cheese in there, otherwise it doesn't taste good. And then fry it in olive oil. You fry it. Make little balls. We make little balls. And those are the bimuelos. And for me, Pesach, Passover, is really so associated with certain foods. Bimuelos is one of them. And the other one is sodra. Sodre,
okay.
I don't know why it's called like a sodre is a deaf woman. I don't know why it's called like that. But anyway, it tastes very good. That's also with masa. Of course, it's Passover, so you try to be creative with the masa foods. And that you have little pieces of the masa, and you boil it the way you would be boil pasta.
Uh-huh.
In water,
uh-huh.
olive oil, and lemon.
Uh-huh.
Again, like with the Romano cheese, the cheese for the bimuelos, you have to have mm-hmm. even more lemon than you think. I usually use a whole lemon for a little portion of the sodra. And then after that, when all the water is finished, you know, dissolved, absorbed, you take it off the fire, take the whole thing off the fire, leave it for a while, and then you add a beaten egg. And it's good. It's good. It's good stuff. It's very good stuff. So those two foods are, I've told my students, it's not Passover without those two foods and singing of Kavritiko, which is, if people know in Hebrew, Hadgadya in Ladino. Without the Kavritiko, there's no Pesach. That's the main thing, you know?
So
not
now,
very religious sounding.
Right, right. Well, now, what I'm intrigued about, so your bimuelos, or whatever you call them, say it again, how you say it?
Bimuelos, it's
B-I-M-U-E-L-O-S. So it's a little bit different than what I know as bumuelos, which would be more sweet, and maybe that's what you were talking about. Some people, some Jewish people also make those as well. But maybe this, what you're talking about, is a little bit different. But is it almost like, it sounds almost like what would be like a matzah ball that's fried, right?
Oh, no, you're killing it.
I'm not trying to kill. But if but I'm saying if you're taking,
are good in their place, but bimuelos are different. The consistency. Now you're getting, you know, food is
charred. But what I'm saying is you're taking matzah, right?
Yeah.
As a base, and you're adding cheese to it and an egg.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's why I was saying it's a similar.
Yeah.
But I understand.
I was half kidding.
Okay.
But
only
but
half.
Yeah, but the only half. But the texture is special of the bimuelos. At least the way I like them. I don't like them so concentrated. I like matzo balls as long as they don't put them in chicken broth because I'm vegetarian. But anyway, the bimuelos I like a looser texture and not really in balls, but in like free form things. You know,
okay.
That you put in. That's my taste. So it's a different taste. They're all good.
Okay.
They're all
okay.
good. But this is okay. different. And food, the one thing I must say about the food, Sephardic food, is I grew up with arroz, rice is the main thing. And
that's what I was
going to... Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With con tomate. It's always with the tomato juice, not tomato sauce. My mother used to make it with tomato juice and water and oil. So it was really not so strong as like the typical Spanish rice that you get in restaurants around here, which I like also.
Mm-hmm.
She used to put chicken broth too. I don't put the chicken broth because I'm vegetarian.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that really is special.
Uh huh. So my grandmother used to make rice. She would call it arroz japonés, which would be white rice, and then she would add, you know, like tomato.
Yeah.
Tomato to it with a little bit of the tomato juice, but that was it. Wasn't, and maybe a little bit of fried onion, but that was just
that sounds good.
That was just every once in a blue moon, and then but primarily we had a lot of rice with saffron as well, especially you know for paella. But do you do anything that so rice? Rice, vegetables. Tell me some other, and you talked about your bimuelos. Tell me about some other food that.
Bamya.
What's that?
Which bamya, we call it by the Turkish name. I think it is Turkish. Bamya, and it's okra.
Okra. Uh oh.
Yeah. You know, okra.
I'm not really a fan of okra. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, if you had the bamya, it'd be a little different. First of all, they have to be. Yeah. They. It's not. I like okra anyway.
Really?
Even the way it's made, like fried or something, I've had things like that. But the bamya is special. First of all, you have to choose, and I'm thinking my mother's talking to me right now, you have to choose very, very tender ones, tender small ones, if you can get. My mother always said, you don't make something just because you think you want to make it. You make it because they have good ones in the grocery store. You know, that's what you do. You make what's good. You make what's good and fresh. So the bamya, definitely very tender, and that's made with also, that's our formula for a lot of things, the tomato juice and oil and water, you know, that's the formula for it, but they come out good, and lay them very nicely. Of course, you have to arrange the presentation. We're hot on presentation.
Okay.
It has to be hermoso. It has to be beautiful. It's not
uh-huh.
enough that it's delicious. You don't just throw things at you. It has to be really presented. So even when they're in the pot, they have to be beautiful and laid out. And then you just cook them very, very slowly. You have to really look at the food. My mother said that my grandmother, whom I never knew, unfortunately, my Miriam Avram Ganon, my mother's mother, used to say that, you know, with the food is a funny thing. The stove said, I don't know, that stove doesn't like my back. Every time I turn my back, the food gets bad. So you have to look at the food all the time. It's not enough to time it. There's no such thing time. You stand there and nurture it.
You stand there.
And, you know, you really
there's
a coach to the food. You have to say, come on, you can do it. Yeah?
Well, you know, you really kind of have to, right? I mean,
yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
That's, but, you know, okra, it's just the first time I had it, I was like, bleh. I just didn't like it. It was one of these things.
Well, it can be very mushy. If you don't cook it
slimy.
Right, it can be very, you know, slimy. Yeah, I don't like slimy.
Slimy.
Either. No.
Yeah.
No.
And I was like, no thanks, you know, because it kind of reminded me of a vegetable that was soaked in, like, aloe vera or something, you know. It was like, oh,
yeah.
Man, what
yeah.
is this? Yeah. So,
yeah.
Anyway, so thank you for talking about the food. Now, I want Dolores to, and you know what, folks, we're going to have to do for part two because it's already, we've only got 15 minutes left. So I'm going to ask Dolores if you can kind of talk, I'll give you like, if you can do this in 5 to 8 minutes, talk about the culture and the customs, Dolores. And then we're going to have to close it out, folks, and we're going to have to catch up the next time because, you know, we're almost out of time. So, Dolores?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to use my advantage here as the last one to comment and say that in the issue of Halavid, which is the Journal of the Society for Crypto-Judaic Studies, which I edited for the last issue, is a whole article on imuelos, bormuelos, whatever you want to call them, in different recipes. So I was delighted to hear Gloria's take on it. And about when you were talking about being in Spain and seeing faces that made you feel at home, that happened to me in northern New Mexico when I noticed that all the little old ladies looked like my aunts. And the more I looked at the people I thought were Hispanic, the more they looked like my relatives. And that was in northern New Mexico. So, you know, it happens in more than in Spain. It happens wherever people from Spain settled.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I'll get to my assignment. about the customs, right. Now, in places like Providence, Rhode Island, or in Santa Fe, New Mexico, you find that people will sweep the floor, people who have either Portuguese or Spanish background, will be sweeping the floor toward the middle. Now, not everyone, but most of the people of that background living in those areas do that. And it turns out that that's a Sephardic Jewish way of sweeping the floor, because you're not supposed to sweep dirt out the door, because in doing that, you'll be sweeping it past the mezuzah, which is the first five books of the Bible, the Jewish Torah, which is on paper and in a little box that Sephardic and all Jews can put in their doorway. And so if you're going to sweep the floor past that, by sweeping the dirt out the door, you're going to defile the mezuzah. Well, there are very good Catholic and Christian families in northern New Mexico, in Providence, Rhode Island, who sweep the floor toward the middle, like the Sephardic Jews. Then, in these same places and other places like that, we find that when people die, there are families who are Hispanic that cover mirrors, which is also a Sephardic, and in fact it's also it's a Jewish custom to cover the mirrors in the home where somebody has just been bereaved.
Dolores, I just wanted to ask you really quick, does that signify mourning or something? Is that what it signifies?
It does. The idea is that you're not supposed to do anything in the way of vanity because you're in mourning.
Uh-huh.
And you're supposed to be very serious, so you're not to look at yourself. I think that's the main reason. Also, I've had Hispanic people tell me that when someone dies, they sit in certain chairs only that are very hard. And Jews who are mourning, who are observant, will do something called sitting shiva, which means they'll sit on boxes, very hard boxes, for the whole period of mourning. And so this is a custom that carried over, and it's an indication of that. And also in northern New Mexico, which is very rural, you will find that the manner of slaughtering animals is very similar to kashrut, or the halakhic way of slaughtering animals, which is to drain the blood and bury it. I think, you know, you can say that that this is an indication that these folks had some Sephardic background. So that's one of the comments I'd like to make. The other, of course, is the lighting of candles. As I said, in Rhode Island, Portuguese families do this. Many of them with that ancestry do this, and they don't even know why they do it. They just look at you and say, well, we've always done it this way. And I have a friend who's no longer with us, Flavio. When he was a boy, he used to help his father just before Christmas. He'd go up on the roof, and they'd put 9 little luminarias up there. Those are the wax bags that you put candles in New Mexico, and you light them. And they would put 9 on the roof. And his father was very precise that you had to put 9 up there. And he would say, Papa, why do we do 9? Everyone else is lighting up the whole roof. And his father would look at him and say, we always did it this way. And then years later, when, you know, Flavio figured out that they had Sephardic ancestry, and he learned about Hanukkah, that there are 8 candelabras, 8 candles at the last day. And for some reason, in Flavio's family, through the centuries, when they had no training in Judaism, it just became 9. And what they were doing was really lighting a Hanukkah, which many call a menorah, up on their roof, and they didn't even realize it.
Yeah, it's interesting. The other day when I was talking to you and you told me, you said, so Joey, let me ask you something. How did your family... Did you when they swept the floor, did they sweep to the middle? And I'm like, what? You know, and because nobody's ever asked me that before, right? And then I said, yeah, we've always swept to the middle. We've always swept. And interesting, and then you told me the rest of it. And so we've always done that. But what's interesting, what makes me think of what you just told me or what you just told all of us about disrespect out the door, you know, if you sweep it out the door. I know that there have been times that I've been at people's houses when they're sweeping and they sweep out the door, and it really bothers me. It's like, why would you do that? You know, first of all, you don't have a dustpan, and why are you sweeping out the door? Why don't you just, you know, just get all that stuff and just bring it to the middle or to one corner, and then just, you know. So that's interesting. It really is, because we never know where those, I mean, here, I never knew about it until you told me. So thank you for telling me.
Yeah,
I really appreciate that. Yeah, that's, I mean, it was an eye opener for me. So, you know, this time today has gone really, really quickly, folks, because we've got about 9 minutes left, and really we don't, because by the time I'm done and saying our goodbyes and all this, and I know it's gone so quickly, and again, I want to thank everybody that joined me. I want to thank Rachel Amado Bortnick. I want to thank Dolores Sloan. I want to thank Gloria Asher. I want to thank Brian. Yeah, a ti también. Brian Kirshen, right? Is that right, Brian? Is that how you say it?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. And I want to remind the audience that all, in case you want to get in touch with any of them, their information is on the website, and so please feel free to do that. Know that we are going to have part 2 of this, and there's so many things that we haven't even touched on that we were going to touch on this evening, but again, the time just ran really quickly. The really neat thing about this program, though, it's going to go in the archives. Not only that, starting at about midnight tonight, it will be on the network as one of the featured staff picks for 24 hours, so anybody going on this network will see this show and they'll be able to hear it. But the next show, I want to touch on the music, which I think is very, very important, and we want to touch on that. We want to talk about, and Rachel did talk a little bit about the Spanish surnames, but we want to get more into that. We want to know things like, what about today's modern Spaniard that is a practicing Jew? Are they Sephardic too? Even even if their families were originally Christians. We're going to touch on that. Are there some Jews that don't even acknowledge or know anything about the Sephardim? We're going to touch on that. Are their practices and traditions the same as other Jews? We're going to touch on that. And really quickly, I want you to tell our listeners, Rachel, tell us really quickly. You have 2 minutes to do this if you can. Are there any events that the listeners might be interested in attending in the near future?
May I do that for Rachel?
Okay, yes, Dolores, yeah, we have 2 minutes.
Okay, July 28th to 30th in Colorado Springs, the Society for Crypto-Judaic Studies will be having a conference, and you'll be able to hear speakers talking about touching on many of the areas that we've covered today, but mostly about the crypto-Jews, the people who came there as Spanish converted Jews.
Okay.
And I don't want to take up too much time, so I'll let you cut me off.
Okay, and I don't mean to cut you off, but I just want to know really quickly, is there a website that they can go to find this out?
Yes, it is. It's called CryptoJews.com, CryptoJews. Be sure you put the S in, and then it's .com, CryptoJews.com. And there'll be all kinds of information, plus information on some of the things I spoke about.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, you know, folks, I know that I have learned so much. I know that the listeners have learned so much, and the ones that will be listening in the future are going to learn so much. And there's really, actually, you guys have just been wonderful. There are actually right now listening this evening, there are people, very important people out there in the listening audience. I'm not going to tell you who they are, but they are listening to the show, and I'm sure, and some of them are Sephardic Jews as well. They are really proud and very honored. And you know, I think what all of you contributed tonight has been so significant and a great blessing to many people. And I know from the bottom of my heart, I thank you so much for joining me and for really giving people a better understanding of who the Sephardic people really are, their culture. Although it just seems like it was just moments ago that we started this show, it's already been nearly 2 hours. Can you believe that? It's kind of hard to believe. Well, I'm wondering, because did I lose some people there, or is anybody falling asleep? I hope not. But it went quick. It went quickly, and thank you so much. And so until the next time, I just want to wish you well. I want to thank every one of you that joined me here tonight, and I want to thank the listeners out there that are listening and that have gleaned so much from this evening. So thank you, and I would say muchas gracias a todos, and you know, I just I know that this will be a blessing to many, many people that listen. So be sure to share this. And then I'll look forward to you guys in the future having you on and us being able to talk more about this. It's just a shame that we weren't able to finish everything that we had planned. But, you know, this is life. So until the next time.
Thank you, Joey. Thank you for us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. So just stay there. Don't hang up yet. Stay there. And I want to thank the audience again. Be sure to pass the show on to your friends and your family and whomever. And again, realize that it is going to be replayed this very, well, early morning. Starting at midnight, it's going to replay on the network. And then it's going to go into the archives. So again, on behalf of myself here, Live from the Bay with Joey, I thank you so much. I thank the guests that joined me, and I thank you, the listener. So take care.
Thank you for joining us today on Live from the Bay with Joey.